Well, back in the day, Lisa and I used to really enjoy watching a TV show called The Amazing Race. And if you've never seen it before, it was a reality competition show that involved teams of two traveling all over the world and competing in tasks in various locations in order to move on to the next round. And at the end of the show, the team that finished first would win $1 million. And many of these tasks were designed to terrify the contestants and force them to overcome their fears. So for example, they would have to bungee jump off of a really tall bridge or get into a cage and be submerged into a lake full of crocodiles. Regardless of how scared the contestants were, they almost always were able to suppress their fears and conquer the task. But I have a challenge that would have stopped the show right in its tracks. They could have forced the contestants to preach a sermon on Revelation, and no one would have finished. After all, that prospect strikes absolute terror into the hearts of most clergy I know. However, since I'm a bit of a theological adrenaline junkie, we're going to give it a go today. Now, the book of Revelation, and mind you, it is singular, Revelation, not Revelations. It belongs to a genre known as apocalyptic literature. And that word itself, apocalyptic, means an unveiling. And these apocalyptic visions typically involve pulling back the veil between heaven and earth to reveal the spiritual reality beyond our physical one. And just as we today are familiar with different kinds of literary genres, such as fantasy, adventure, biography, that apocalyptic genre would have been very familiar to Jews in the first century. Unfortunately, modern readers tend to read it in ways that first century Jews would not have read it. Part of the problem is that apocalyptic literature relies heavily on symbols and imagery to convey its message, but if we don't understand those symbols, then we run the risk of wildly misinterpreting what the text says. So, for example, if I were to say to you all, the eagle and the bear will engage in a battle but draw no blood until the barrier between them is torn down and there is peace, most of you would probably know that I was referring to the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the 20th century, and that barrier that was torn down refers to the Berlin Wall. Of course, it all makes sense, right? And it's obvious to most of us, but if you told this story to someone who was maybe born after the year 2000, or someone who grew up in a rural village in India, they may not have that same point of reference for those symbols. So they might think that you're talking about an actual eagle and an actual bear, or they may start assigning their own meaning to those symbols. Now, these things are the things that we need to watch out for when we study the book of Revelation. We need to remember that this vision is given to John at a specific point in history and for a specific reason. So before we can understand what it means for us today, we have to understand what it meant when it was written. Of course, that's easier said than done. The traditional dating of the book of Revelation has it being written towards the end of the first century during the reign of Domitian. However, others have argued that it was written much earlier during the reign of Nero, before the fall of Jerusalem in the year 70. Now, good arguments can certainly be made for both of these options, but regardless of which date you prefer, we need to remember that both of these time periods represent difficult times for the young church. Although the church was growing and expanding and the gospel was going out, many Christians were already starting to experience persecution. If we look at Nero's time, we know that Nero blamed the Christians and used them as scapegoats for the great fire that destroyed Rome in the year 64. And we also know Nero disliked the Christians so much that he used their bodies as torches at his garden parties. Not a nice guy. Now, it's also believed that Domitian was a persecutor of Christians, and he put many Christians to death towards the end of his own reign. Even for those early churches that were not already being persecuted, the future did not look very rosy, and martyrdom would be a real possibility for Christians during the next 200-plus years. It's important to keep all of this in mind when we're studying the book of Revelation. What we may often think of as scary or foreboding is actually quite the opposite. This vision was given to John not as a way of scaring people into behaving themselves, but rather it was a way to encourage the church to follow Jesus wholeheartedly, even in the midst of tribulation. The overall message of the book is that times will be difficult, Christians will suffer, and many will even be killed for their faith, but Jesus has already won the battle against evil and death. And as a result, future glory awaits all of the saints. Now, this theme is beautifully summarized in our lesson from Revelation today. If we look back earlier in chapter 7, we see that John presents a list of the 144,000 of Israel who have been sealed. And we don't have a whole lot of time to go into numerology today, but in apocalyptic writing, numbers are often more qualitative than quantitative. So we see that there are 12 tribes of Israel listed, and there are 12,000 people from each tribe. And so this 12 times 12,000 gives us the number 144,000. And this is not an exact number, but rather it represents a complete multitude. Our reading this morning begins at verse 9, where John says, "After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands." This vision tells us that God's covenant of salvation has been opened up not just to Israel, but now to all nations. The white robes, as we will see later, represent those who have been washed in the blood of the Lamb, which means that they've accepted the sacrifice for sin that Jesus has made upon the cross, and they've taken his righteousness upon themselves. The palm branches that we see are symbols of royal adoration, showing that this multitude that no one can number, they all recognize Jesus as the true King of creation. And this all bears out when the multitude declares, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." Now, jumping down to verse 14, the elders say about those clothed in the white robes, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." And before we start letting our minds run wild with what this might mean, we need to understand the context. Remember, this is a vision for a persecuted church. People are literally dying for their faith. When the elders speak about tribulation, they're not referring to some future cataclysmic event, but rather they are addressing the church's current reality. John even refers to himself as your brother and partner in the tribulation back in chapter 1. The point that's being made is that those who have suffered for the sake of the gospel are now in glory. Their suffering has not been in vain. They have been redeemed by Jesus, and now they are in God's presence where their new lives are spent in continual worship before the throne of grace. Now, for those Christians who are already experiencing persecution, as well as for those who soon would be, this was intended to give them hope and strength to persevere. Just as these former saints are now in glory, so too will those who currently suffer be in glory if they continue to stand fast. And we now get a beautiful description of what life in God's presence is like. And it's characterized by worship, provision, and protection. And these are three things that have been denied the martyrs on earth, but they've now been secured for them, now that they have been washed in the blood of the Lamb. And it all culminates with the beautiful phrase, "And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." The assumption, of course, is that there will be suffering. Tears will be shed by the saints, but they will be comforted by the Lord in the end. Well, today we celebrate the Feast of All Saints. As Anglicans, we understand this word saints to refer not only to those holy people of long ago, but to all Christians, both past and present. So we may celebrate St. Patrick, St. Nicholas, or St. Augustine, but there's also St. Jim, and St. Deb, and even St. Larry. Especially St. Larry. Anyone who has accepted the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross and recognizes him as king is what Paul would consider to be a saint in the Lord, or one who has been set apart for God. And although we may live in different times and in a different place than John, his message from his revelation is for us just as much as it was for the people of his own day. Sainthood is not about an easy life or an escape from suffering. Tribulation and hardship have been an unavoidable companion to Christians since the first century. So often when we refer to someone as a saint, we mean that they're a person who is good or virtuous or well-behaved. And while these are all certainly wonderful qualities that we ought to all pursue, the primary characteristic of a saint is perseverance in the midst of adversity. You see, faith is easy when things are going our way. Faith is easy when we can name it and claim it and have our heart's desire. But what about when times are hard? What about when life gets difficult? During those times, do we turn to God or do we turn away from Him? When my daughters were younger, I had the opportunity to coach their cross-country team. You remember that, Allie? Now, coaching a middle school cross-country team can be challenging. It's not that kids don't know how to run. I didn't have to teach anyone how to run. Kids do that naturally. They run on the playground. They run down the hallways of the school. They run at the swimming pool. They run everywhere. The hard part was teaching them how to suffer. I had to train them to overcome their natural inclination to stop running when it got uncomfortable. You see, to be a good runner, you need to be able to push through the pain. You need to be able to keep going when every ounce of your body tells you that you need to slow down or stop. In the end, it's not always the best athlete who wins the race. Oftentimes, it's the athlete who is willing to suffer the most. Now, unfortunately, I think many Christians today are like middle school cross-country runners when it comes to our faith. We're happy to go to church and proclaim Jesus as Lord when things are easy and when things are going well, but as soon as it gets difficult, we're done. That's not what I signed up for. And yet the reality of our own time is that as Christians become more and more of a minority in our country and in the world, we are going to see the persecution of the saints increase. Now, when that happens, how are we going to respond? Will we abandon our faith? Will we moan and groan and complain about how unfair it is? Or will we persevere like the saints of old? The message of John's revelation is that this fallen world, it's not our reward. We will one day serve God day and night in His renewed and restored kingdom. There will come a day when we will hunger and thirst no more, and God will wipe away every tear from our eyes. But before that happens, many tears are destined to fall. But don't get discouraged. Don't give up. If we're going to share the crown of glory in God's kingdom, we must persevere in the meantime. Finally, we need to recognize that the book of Revelation is good news that we can share with a dying world. Now, it may not seem like we're painting a very pretty picture of the Christian life here. We're essentially saying to people, come and suffer with us. I'm sure the lost and the broken will be anxious to sign up right away. But the truth of the matter is that anything that promises you that you won't suffer is lying. The truth is that although this world promises to give us all that we could ever want in this life, and that if you take this pill or if you do this program, you will no longer suffer, the reality is that we all suffer. And we all will suffer. We all hurt. We all face trials and persecutions. Nobody gets through this life unscathed or unscarred. The Christian faith does not offer us a life free of pain, but it can offer us something that the world can't. Jesus offers us a sure hope to sustain us in this life as we await the fulfillment of God's kingdom. We all have pain now, but only Jesus offers us glory in the age to come. So surrender yourself today to Jesus, the shepherd of your soul. Life is hard, but He will guide you to springs of living water, and He will wipe away every tear from your eye. And that, my friends, is what it means to be a saint. Thanks be to God. Amen.